You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our discussion today on what I think is the existential defining question of our time, of our age, is how to stop this campaign of terror and violence being orchestrated by Daesh or ISIS. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe, and welcome to all friends here. Sadly, ISIS is constantly in the headlines, and while we're all united in horror at what we see and what we hear, we're still struggling to come up really with a comprehensive strategy. I wonder if we actually ever can, but this is the discussion here today. How do we forge a comprehensive strategy for stopping this rise and expansion of Daesh? Now, what has been recently in the headlines, of course, all the time, coalition and U.S. airstrikes against Daesh strongholds. Washington is sending 450 more personnel in non-combat roles to assist the Iraqi government. There's speculation that this could soon be followed by more troops going to Iraq. Of course, it's a vastly costly exercise. The U.S. alone is spending $9 million a day, according to some reports, on the war against the Islamic State. And of course, what's really of great concern to everyone is that the toxic message of ISIS is spreading across many, many parts of the Muslim, of the Islamic world. So at today's conference, we'll be looking at some special questions that we have to come about, talking to Paul and others. What will it take? What will it really take to defeat ISIS, dismantle its networks? How effective are these coalition airstrikes that we see in the headlines all the time? And what are the essential, and I think this is something very important, what are the essential ingredients of peace in Iraq? What's needed to bring peace in Iraq? So to discuss these and other questions, we have together now a very, very interesting, experienced panel of experts who've been looking at this issue from different points of view. We're really delighted to have such experts with us today. Sheikh Jamal Al-Dhari on my left is president of the Peace Ambassadors for Iraq. It's an NGO. And of course, we all know him as a senior Iraqi tribal leader of the Al-Zoba tribe in Iraq. He's going to be interpreted by Johnny Tommy, who's a member of the bureau of this NGO in Europe. So Johnny will be interpreting. He's helping us out on this one. To my right, not immediate right, but a little further, is Suad Mekane. She's very well known as a correspondent of the National Security Desk of the Washington Post. She's been reporting on radical movements since 9/11, and recently she unmasked Jihadi Johnny. Jihadi Johnny, and also you've interviewed the security commander of the Abu Bakr Baghdadi, so you've really done some very, very investigative reporting on this issue. And here to my right is Paul Hamill, senior a fellow at American Security Project, and we're also expecting Mariette Schaake from the European Parliament soon. The rules of the game are simple. I'm going to ask a series of questions to start off to the Sheikh and to all others of you here as well. And then we will have open the questions from you, comments from you, and we'll try and make this as interactive as possible. So, Sheikh Jamal, I'm really going to start off with you with this issue of where is the support for ISIS coming from? What is the reason that we cannot defeat it, that it's expanding? Its tentacles really are reaching out beyond the region and within the region.
بداية أشكر لكم هذا الحضور.
In the beginning, I just welcome you all and thank you for being here.
وأعتقد من المهم جدا أن يعرف العالم حقيقة ما يجري في منطقتنا.
And it's very important, and I believe it's very important that people know what's going on in our area.
وتستطيعون أن تعتبروني شاهد من المحرقة.
And you can consider me as a witness of a burning place.
القصة الحقيقية ليست هي التي تذكر في الإعلام
The true story is not what you hear in the media.
والذي يطرح في المؤتمرات الدولية ليس الحل الحقيقي.
And what is been given as a solution in the international conferences and meetings is not the real solution. What it is.
نحن نعتقد أن الوقت قد حان.
We believe that the time has come.
أن يعرف الرأي العام ماذا يحصل في العراق.
That the international community and people knows what's going on really in Iraq.
لأنه الحكومات في الغرب عادة تمثل الشعوب.
Because usually the government in the world are representing the people.
وليست كما عندنا هناك فصل تام بين الحكومات والشعوب.
Not like we are facing in Iraq that separation between the people and the government.
لذلك يجب على الرأي العام أن يعرف ماذا يجري على الأرض كي تغير الحكومات في الغرب من السياسة المتبعة في معالجة الإرهاب.
So the world has the right to know actually, and the people has to know what's going on in Iraq so that they can be able to change the situation.
المشكلة عندنا في العراق بدأت في عام 2003.
The problem in Iraq started in 2003.
كان الناس يتوقعون أن تتغير حياتهم نحو الأفضل.
People they were expecting that their life will be changed for a better life.
لكن للأسف تغيرت حياتهم نحو الأسوأ.
But unfortunately it was the vice versa. It got worse.
لم تكن هناك قاعدة في العراق قبل عام 2003.
There were no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before 2003.
هذا ليس دفاعا عن نظام صدام.
This is not defending Saddam's regime.
هو ارتكب أخطاء كثيرة.
He made a lot of mistakes and
لذلك الشعب العراقي يستحق نظام أفضل منه.
That's why the Iraqi people deserve better, much better regime than Saddam.
لكن الذي حصل أن القاعدة دخلت بعد عام 2003.
But what happened? Al-Qaeda entered after 2003.
ونتيجة السياسة المتبعة بعد عام 2003 كبر الإرهاب.
And the results of the policy what was in Iraq. The terrorism got bigger and bigger.
حتى أعلن عن دولة العراق الإسلامية في عام 2006.
Till the moment in 2006, it was announced the Islamic States.
حصلت معركة بين القبائل السنية ودولة العراق الإسلامية في عام 2007.
The tribal military had a battle against Al-Qaeda in 2007.
واندحرت.
And they defeated.
لكن استمرار نفس السياسة التي ولدت وأنشأت هذا الإرهاب.
But the same policy what started in 2003, which actually because of it came the terrorism.
جعل منها تعود بنسخة أكبر وأكثر تطورا.
Brought something new, bigger and more. I mean, bigger than the Islamic States.
وحتى أعلن في عام 2013 عن دولة العراق والشام الإسلامية.
And as you see, 2013 was announced the ISIS, I mean the Islamic States.
خرج الناس في ست محافظات سنية يرفعون مطالب لإنصافهم وتحقيق حياة طبيعية.
Came out the people on the street demanding, having demands and raising their voices to the government just to asking them to listen to them.
شن عليهم المالكي هجوم بدعوى أنهم إرهابيون.
So المالكي attacked them by the reason that they are terrorists.
حصل على دعم من المجتمع الدولي.
So he got the support from the international community and West.
بعد ذلك كلكم تعرفون ماذا حصل. استولت داعش على الموصل وصلاح الدين.
So as you know, afterward Daesh took Al-Mosul and Salah al-Din.
فأعلنت دولة الخلافة الإسلامية.
So it was announced the Al-Khilafa state. No, the Islamic. Yeah, the Islamic. Yeah, yeah.
نستنتج من هذا المسلسل.
We are taking
نستنتج من هذا المسلسل أن الإرهاب يكبر شيئا فشيئا.
We are seeing that from all the serial what's going on, we are seeing that terrorism is getting bigger day by day.
وهذا قطعا يدل على أن هناك طريقة خاطئة في معالجة هذه المشكلة.
And this is showing that there is a wrong way of treating the problem in Iraq.
حتى كتب قبل فترة أحد الصحفيين في الصحافة البريطانية.
As it was written in the British media.
يتندر على قصة قتل بن لادن أنه لو كان بن لادن الآن حيا لكان أفضل يمكن التفاهم معه.
He said that bin Laden, if he was alive today, it was easier to deal with him than dealing with ISIS.
فالذي يحصل الآن حقيقة على المجتمع الدولي على الرأي العام أن يعرف ماذا يحصل في العراق قبل أن يأتي وقت لا يمكن لأحد أن يتدارك هذه المشكلة.
So finally, it's time that people know what's going on in Iraq so that they can be able at least to find a solution before this time comes out and there will be no solution at all.
أنا أعتقد ست دقائق.
Yeah, I do have a follow-up. I do have a follow-up. So you're saying that the basic roots come from the sectarian division inside Iraq between the Shias and the Sunnis. And is it the case that Sunnis are reluctant to join the battle against ISIS because they fear the Shia militias even more than they fear ISIS? Is that how you would say it, Sheikh Jamal?
I need to translate.
Yes.
الحقيقة هو يراد تصوير الموضوع على أن هناك معركة بين السنة والشيعة وهذا ليس في مصلحة المنطقة.
Actually, people are seeing that as if there is a war between the Shia and the Sunni now.
هذا ليس في مصلحة المنطقة وليس في مصلحة العالم.
It's not of the interest of the area. I mean, Middle East and even not the world. It's not for.
المشكلة أنه بعد عام 2003.
The problem is that after 2003.
كان العراقيون ينتظرون الديمقراطية التي هي نموذج للحكم تدار فيه المجتمعات في الغرب.
After 2003, the Iraqi was waiting actually a better life, a democratic life, like everybody is living around.
وهذه التجربة كان الناس في مجتمعاتنا ينتظرونها. يوما بعد آخر.
Day by day, these people were really praying and waiting this democracy in Iraq.
لكن الذي حصل أننا ابتلينا بديمقراطية غير مسبوقة في العالم.
We got some special edition democratic regime. Never happened in the
world. لم أحد يسمع من قبل بديمقراطية الطوائف.
No one heard before about the religious democratic democracy.
شكل بريمر مجلس حكم من 25 عضو.
Bremer made a council out of 25 members.
13 منهم شيعة.
13 of them is Shia.
5 سنة.
5 Sunni.
5 أكراد.
5 Kurds.
1 مسيحي.
1 Christian.
1 تركماني.
1 Turkmen.
فقالوا لنا هذه ديمقراطية.
And they told us that this is democracy.
لكن الحقيقة الشيعي الذي يحمل أجندة شيعية.
The Shia who has a Shia agenda.
وليس الشيعي المواطن العادي.
But that the normal Shia, not the normal.
الذي يحمل أجندة طائفية سيعمل على تحقيق أجندته.
The Shia who's holding the Shia agenda, of course, he will work according to his own agenda.
وكذلك السني وكذلك الكردي.
And also the Kurdish and also the Sunni.
فهم شركاء متشاكسون.
They are all partners in this.
شركاء متشاكسون وليسوا متعاونون.
They are opposite partners but not cooperative partners.
لأن كل واحد منهم يعمل لمصلحته ومصلحة حزبه وطائفته.
Because everyone is doing his own benefit and his own interest for his own party and his own agenda.
وهذا الذي أسس لمشكلة الطائفية في العراق.
And this is the main reason what there is problem now, religious problem in Iraq.
Thank you, Sheikh Jamal. We'll come back to you with some questions about how to go beyond what you've just described. Sawad, I do want to ask you to comment on what you've heard. Do you believe that this is the basic problem that we are facing in the region, in Iraq at the moment. This divide, and that ISIS is getting support from Sunni tribes because of the fear of Shia militias, and that's going to be very difficult to break that. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. Thanks for coming, and thanks for my two speakers here. You know, I was in Iraq in 2003. I was one of the youngest reporters back then. And as a matter of fact, one of the missions why I was brought in, and I don't know if you all remember, but in 2003, there was this story that came up that an Iraqi diplomat had met with Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 pilots. And the story that was flowing around was somehow that this Iraqi diplomat had met Mohammed Atta before the 9/11 attacks and gave him money and instructions in Prague. So my mission was to find the Iraqi diplomat. So in 2003, which I did, by the way, I managed to find him, and he denied that this meeting has ever taken place. And we all know that the story was not true. But I'm telling you this for a reason, because we have to remember, why did this invasion in Iraq actually happen? Why did it take place? And why did it, you know, why did the United States of America and Great Britain enter this country? And I only say weapons of mass destruction. And we all know that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And it sometimes is important also to understand where some of the Arabs, or let's say, you know, maybe I have to use the word Sunnis, come from, why there is a lot of mistrust now towards the United States and also European countries when it comes to promises, when it comes to, you know, invitations, that now people have learned their lessons. Very often we have to remember, why actually did we enter this country? That's the first point. And now in 2003, I did see something on the ground, which people described to me as, you know, which was described as de-Ba'athification. So, you know, in Iraq, before 2003, before the invasion, what was important was, are you Ba'athist or not? It wasn't important if you're Sunni, if you're Shia, if you're Christian or whatsoever. What was important is, were you a member of the Ba'ath Party or not? And believe me, I've seen enough Shia people who had been members of the Ba'ath Party who were actually also pretty high up in positions. I've seen Kurds, I've seen Christians. So we also, you know, had a little bit, I would say, maybe a wrong kind of coverage when we entered this war, this conflict, by describing it as a Sunni-Shia conflict. And I'm saying this also because I have the impression sometimes today, when we look at the region, we describe things and conflicts very often easily as a Sunni-Shia divide. And I would really urge everybody here to look more in-depthly into what is really going on in countries, for example, in Bahrain. Now, coming to the situation in Iraq, and what we are facing today. Based on, so we had a lot of members of the army, of the security service, the intelligence service, who all of a sudden were sent home. They had weapons, but then, because they were members of the Ba'ath Party, or because Mr. Chalabi had this great idea of dissolving the army and the police, these members of the armed forces found themselves without a job. They had all weapons, and they were all very angry. And throughout my stay in Iraq, I stayed there for 6 months in 2003 after the fall of the Saddam regime, I met some of these people and I started, you know, interviewing them, and I followed their lives. And it became very apparent that these people found themselves in a corner. And they said, well, what's the alternative? We see that there are Shia militias who are allowed to have weapons, who come into our neighborhoods and tell Sunnis we have to leave the neighborhood because we want this to be a Shia neighborhood. And they were, of course, very angry. And at some stage, some of these very well-trained people said, we're going to join Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group. Now, This is also why ISIS today is in a very good shape. Not only did they recruit many of these very well-trained former intelligence officials, by the way, they have their own intelligence service. ISIS has their own intelligence service. They are they recruited people from the armed forces. They recruited people from the Fedayeen of Saddam Hussein. So you have a very well-trained group of people. And the problem that I see, and I have to, I can only, you know, confirm what your analysis is, because I'm talking to some people who are now living under the caliphate, some Sunnis who are telling me, look, we don't like ISIS necessarily, but on the other hand, what is our choice? We cannot trust the British, we cannot trust the Americans, because they have promised so much. As soon as the Americans left Iraq officially, the first thing Maliki did was he went after al-Hashimi, who was actually very, very famous among Sunni tribes. He's Sunni and who helped with his tribes to defeat al-Qaeda at some stage. And so this person had to leave Iraq. Now, there's a lack of trust, and I think this is one of the key problems, because indeed, some of the people that I talk to, they say to me, if we have to choose between, getting killed, I'm just quoting them now, by Shia militias, or have to live under ISIS, which we dislike, but at least we have a chance to survive, we'll choose ISIS. This is what we see in Iraq. But let me also get a little bit broader, if you allow me. There is, because ISIS is not only recruiting in Iraq. ISIS is recruiting throughout the Middle East. ISIS is recruiting in Europe, and they are very successful in this. Because on a different level, we see now there are the talks with Iran, you know, the nuclear talks. And by also allowing not only Shia militias to fight, but you have, as a matter of fact, you have the Iranian Revolutionary Guards now on the ground in Syria. You have them on the ground in Iraq. It's all official. Everybody knows this. Some people around the area have the impression that, as a matter of fact, the West is actually leaning more towards Iran and is abandoning, I'm quoting again, abandoning all the Sunni Muslims. And now that's a very dangerous, you know, it's a very, very dangerous game, because if you believe that the war, you can, it's actually a vicious circle. By supporting that this group, you are actually telling the other group, or some people might think within the other group, okay, we have no other choice but joining ISIS to fight these militias. So that's the macro, on the macro level, another problem.
Thanks, Fuad. I'm going to turn to Paul. Paul, once you've heard Sheikh Jamal and now Fuad sort of basically reaffirming the same thing, I was just wondering, so these coalition strikes, this non-combat training that's going to be given, and then possibly troops going in, I mean, does that then serve any purpose if there is this massive support? Are these coalition strikes going to be the solution, or what is the way forward, do you think?
Well, again, thank you so much for the invite to join in the panel with such distinguished panelists. I probably have a little less to say, having you've explained it incredibly well. I mean, we have to look at the fundamental issue that this conflict we're seeing is a political issue. It is a political conflict. And if we overlay it with a military answer, we're actually going to make things worse. And I think this is what we're seeing. As you quite rightly said, is we're actually being seen by a vast majority of the region of supporting Iranian militias and the Iranian so-called plan for the region. And if we're seen as that, this becomes, again, very dangerous, and it's spiraling out of control. And we in the West are actually forcing people to tentatively support ISIS. And unless we realize this, and unless we change our policies, unless we, as the President of the United States recently said, get a strategy, we're going to be faced by doing this over and over again. We saw it with Al-Qaeda, we're seeing it with ISIS. If we don't solve the fundamental political problems, and we just look at the symptoms, the patient is going to get worse and worse.
That begs the follow-up. What is the basic political solution? More representation for the Sunni tribes in the Iraqi government setup? What is the political settlement that you would envisage for Iraq?
I mean, it's got to be, first of all, up to the whole of Iraq and the whole of Iraq is to decide this. But we in the West need to realize that the political, social, and economic settlement that we thought the Iraqis bought into, they haven't. And it is completely broken. And so every time we go around saying, we're going to give the Baghdad government this, we're going to give the Baghdad government that, without saying they have to do X, Y, and Z, and hold them to that, we are driving recruitment for the bad guys. And so, I don't have an answer to say what the Baghdad government should look like, but we have to realize what it looks like now is not working, and is adding to our problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a fundamental rethink. I just want to, before I open the floor to comments and questions from yourselves, all of you here, I want to do, Sheikh Jamal, ask you a question about financing of ISIS. Thank you, Paul. About the financing of ISIS. I mean, obviously, there's massive amount of money there that's being used in all kinds of different ways. And the money seems to be coming from clandestine criminal activities, from ransoms, from hijackings, funding from certain governments, authorities, control of oil fields, obviously, in Iraq and in Syria, the financial sector. I mean, it's such a huge network. It's so complicated, this network. How do you think you can fight ISIS from that side of by actually throttling the source of finance? Is that one way?
إذا كنا نتكلم عن الدعم المالي ومن أو من أين يأتي المال لداعش.
If we are talking about from where the finance comes or the money comes, the source of income of ISIS.
الأهم من هذا الأمر هو التحاق الناس بداعش.
The important thing is not the finance of ISIS, but the people joining ISIS.
لأنه الذي يحصل الآن كله يغذي داعش.
Because what is going on now, it's feeding Daesh, feeding ISIS. It's a source of fear.
أقرب مثال هو لما سيطر داعش على الأنبار.
So one of the example when Daesh already controlled Anbar.
هرب الناس باتجاه العاصمة بغداد.
So the people ran away towards Baghdad.
لكن حكومة العبادي والميليشيات التي تسيطر على الوضع.
And the militias which are controlling the
منعت الناس من الدخول إلى بغداد.
They prevented the people to enter Baghdad, to the capital.
وبقوا هؤلاء أيام وأسابيع في الصحراء.
They stayed days and weeks in the desert.
عوائل, نساء,
families,
أطفال, حوامل,
women,
مرضى,
pregnant women,
تهرب من داعش.
People run away from Daesh.
تغلق بوجههم المدينة.
And in front of them, they had a
يقضون أيام وليالي في العراء.
They stay days and nights in the desert.
هذا الفعل يدفعهم إلى العودة إلى الأنبار.
This kind of treating them and blocking
إلى
them,
مساكنهم.
They push them to come back to Anbar, to their houses.
فإذا عادوا سيكونون تحت سيطرة داعش.
So if they come back to their houses to Anbar,
ولن يكون لهم خيار
Daesh.
آخر.
Ruling,
ولن يكون لهم خيار آخر.
And they don't have another choice.
ومثل هذه الأمثلة كثير.
And same like this example, many.
أما عن الموضوع المادي فإن داعش سيطرت على الموصل.
So what about financing Daesh?
وهي محافظة وتملك خزينة
Daesh
كبيرة.
Took Mosul, and Mosul is quite a big.
وسيطرت على صلاح الدين.
Big,
وتسيطر على مناطق شاسعة من سوريا.
And they took صلاح الدين, and of course they took many
وهي تسيطر
areas in Syria.
على آلاف الكيلومترات وملايين الناس.
Daesh is controlling millions of
لا
people
أعتقد
and
أنها تعاني الآن من أزمة
so
مالية.
They don't have any problem in finance.
وأنا أعتقد حتى إذا استطاعت تركيا أو غيرها من الدول أن تمنع الناس من القدوم إلى داعش.
Even Turkey is even let's say Turkin, Turkish government is preventing the people to go to join Daesh.
هذه السياسات الخاطئة تغذي داعش.
So the wrong policy and the wrong political decisions are actually feeding Daesh.
وقد تستغربون وقد لا تصدقون إذا
Maybe you will not believe if I'm telling you.
الناس الآن في مناطقنا يتندرون بندرة.
People in our area, they are really coming.
يقولون أن في مناطق من العالم تبحث الناس تنقب الناس عن الذهب.
They say that in some part of the world that people are digging and looking for metal or gold.
وفي مناطق من العالم ينقبون عن الفحم وعن النفط.
And from some others they look for mining of coals and.
أما نحن فننقب عن البشر بعد كل قصف جو.
But we Iraqi we are looking actually after our dead bodies and dead relatives after every invasion or every bombs coming on.
هذه الطلعات اللي بلغت الآن 2500 أو 3000.
These 2,500 or 3,000 airstrike.
تقصف بيوت.
They are hitting houses.
قد يتواجد فيها داعش.
Might be Daesh inside.
لكن مع كل واحد من داعش تقتل العشرات
but
من الناس.
But every Daesh who dies. Tens of normal civilian people.
فهذا الذي مهنته الآن ينقب عن أهله.
So this person who is actually digging for his parents' family.
ماذا نتوقع منه؟
What we expect from him?
بدافع الانتقام.
From just he wanted to take revenge.
سيلتحق بداعش.
So of course he goes to Daesh.
فداعش غنية اليوم بالرجال أكثر مما هي غنية حتى بالمال.
So Daesh today is very rich by people. More than being rich by money.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very quickly, Suad, I'd like you and Paul to come in on this, and then I'll open the floor. If you could prepare your questions.
I'll go first.
Okay.
No, thank you. I mean, what we see in the media, not criticism, all the time about the atrocities that Daesh are doing. The beheadings we've seen and other such. But actually, Sunni leaders and Sunni tribes in Iraq and in the whole region see the disgusting things that the Shia and the Iranian militias are doing. You know, you actually see people being burnt alive by the Iranian militias. You see people being beheaded by the Iranian militias. So the choice that we are helping set out it is between the bad and the very bad. And that is no choice at all. You know, we've got to really fundamentally rethink this. You know, Iraq has the second biggest reserves of oil in the world. And people are starving. Something is really going wrong. And unless we acknowledge this and we hold the present Iraqi leaders to a higher standard, we're going to be faced with this for many years to come.
Yeah, I can confirm what you said. I saw some of these videos. Actually, it's beheadings and also the burnings. I've seen these videos. But, you know, the problem is another one, and it's a little bit the lack of willingness to listen. And I can say this. I have this impression when I talk to people in Washington who are policy advisors. I'm sorry, Paula, I know you're British. I also have the same impression when I talk to policy advisors to the British government. And it's a little bit, you know, I just came in from Geneva and I was sitting there with a couple of people supposedly to be the among the best experts in the Washington area for the Middle East. And for 2 days, we were trying to tell them what's happening on the ground in Iraq, in Syria, how the system of ISIS is working and so on. But you had the impression they came already with their set ideas and they left with their set ideas. And it didn't matter what you were telling them because what the message I heard was, for us in the United States, Salafi jihadis are the bigger threat. Therefore, we are actually in support of the Shia militias and of the Iranians to fight the fight because we don't want to fight the fight. Who's willing to send in ground troops to Iraq and Syria? And, you know, and I was trying to explain to him the logic of, you know, that you are actually indirectly giving ISIS and other Sunnis more and more reason to believe that you are protecting and supporting atrocities committed by other militias. It's the militialization of war, which is very dangerous because the region is flooded really with weapons. You no longer know who is who, who's the friend of who, where are the weapons coming from, where they're going to, and there are more people who are getting trained by special forces. And I can tell you from the interviews I did in the region, also with ISIS fighters, there were some people who were telling me, by the way, we coming from Libya, where we were trained by British, US, or Italian special force, and now we are fighting with ISIS. So, you know, you're sitting here and you think, wait a second, is there actually somebody thinking? I mean, do people really think about long-term strategies? What we're doing today, what does it mean for tomorrow, for Syria in the future, for Iraq in the future, when you have the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in the region? What does it mean long-term for the region? And what does it mean for the partnership with the region? And I have the impression there is a lack of really willingness to listen, unfortunately.
I would like the panel to think about what the role of the international community then should be, because all three of you have criticized what's happening so far, lack of understanding, not listening enough, putting too much weight behind the Shia militias. But do think about, I'll ask you later on, what can we do that makes the situation more less conflict-ridden than it is at the moment. I would like to ask all of you to come in now. If you have a specific question for any one of them, please say so. Otherwise, I'll ask the panel. So I have Bob Cox. I have Mohammed, the lady there. Anyone here? Yes, yourself. Okay, so let's kick off with Bob first. Yeah.
My name is Robert Cox. I'm a trustee of Friends of Europe. Saudi Arabia. We haven't heard much about it in this debate so far. I would like to hear somewhat more about what Saudi Arabia is doing, either as a government or through the Salafists in a wider sense, or not doing in this particular conflict, and what possibly the so-called West could do in leaning upon Saudi Arabia to do something more useful than it seems to be doing at the moment.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bob. That's a very, very relevant question. So I'm actually going to ask you, Sheikh Jamal, to answer that question, and then we'll take others from the floor, please.
الحقيقة بعد 2003 بعد إنشاء النظام السياسي في العراق الجديد.
In reality, after 2003, after establishing the new political
كل الأنظمة في المنطقة دعمت التوجه الأمريكي الذي يدعم هذه العملية السياسية.
All the Middle East governments, including Saudi, supported this.
بما فيهم الحكومة السعودية.
Of course, Saudis was one of the main one who supported.
وطيلة السنين الماضية السعودية نأت بنفسها عن الوضع العراقي. حتى ندموا على ذلك وقال وزير خارجيتهم السابق لقد سلمت أمريكا العراق إلى إيران على طبق من ذهب.
So actually all these years while Saudis were not aware of what's going on in Iraq and leaving the situation being in Iraq like this, the Minister of Foreign Affairs came out and said that Iraq was given to Iran as gift on a plate actually. They woke up finally.
الدولة الوحيدة المتدخلة في الشأن العراقي تدخل ضار هي إيران.
Iran is the main country which is actually dealing with Iraq and interfering in Iraqi's policy and regimes.
والآن هناك مشروعان يتصارعان في العراق.
And now there is two projects in Iraq are fighting.
ولا علاقة للسعودية بالمشروعان.
And Saudis are nothing to do with these two projects.
مشروع أبو بكر البغدادي.
The project of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
ومشروع ولاية الفقيه الإيراني.
And of course the project of the Iranian project ولاية الفقيه.
ومشروع ولاية الفقيه لا يختلف عن مشروع أبو بكر البغدادي.
And of course, the Iranian project it doesn't differ a lot from the Iraq from the Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
بل هو
project.
حتى أقدم من مشروع أبو بكر البغدادي.
But even it's older than Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's project.
الخامنئي اللي الآن هو المرشد الأعلى في إيران.
الخامنئي, which is the leader or the highest leader in Iran.
عنده نظرية ويعمل على هذه النظرية.
He has a vision and he works according to his vision.
ليصبح بعد ذلك قائد لكل المسلمين
so
في العالم.
Be a leader for all Muslims in the world.
لذلك الآن جنرالاته هم الذين يقودون العمليات والميليشيات ضد داعش.
That's why his generals are leading the operations against Daesh on the Iraqi territories.
وهذا جزء كبير من المشكلة.
And this is one of the biggest part of the problem.
ولن يساعد على الحل قطعا.
And of course it will not help in solving any problem.
فهناك الآن مشروعان يتصارعان على العراق يدفع الشعب العراقي ثمن باهظ من هذا الصراع.
Due to these battles between two projects, the Iraqi peoples are paying the price for that.
نحن نقدر أن لكل دول الجوار اهتمام طبيعي في أي دولة جارة.
We believe and of course we know that all the countries around us are interested in us. This is normal.
ونتمنى أن يكون لدول الجوار سواء كان إيران أو السعودية
really,
أو تركيا دور إيجابي في حل
like
المشكلة.
We would like to see at least a positive interfering or solution in Iraq from our neighbors like Iran even and other countries.
لا نمانع بالتدخل النافع لكن لا نمانع في التدخل الضار.
We are against the bad interfering the when Iran is badly reacting, while if she has a good solution, we are welcoming the Iranian solution.
فعلى حد علمي السعودية غير متدخلة في العراق.
And according to what I know, Saudis are nothing to do in Iraq.
Suad, would you like to come in on this?
Well, I see the situation a little different. I think, you know what happened in Yemen. So there is right now in the whole region, and this is why I said we have to look at the situation in Iraq and Syria also a little bit from another kind of layer, which is there is this whole fear of Iranian influence. Now Saudi and others are trying to push back on what they call Iranian influence, and this is why we saw what happened in Yemen. But it's also now I would say going over to Syria and Iraq. There is one cannot say at all that the Saudi government is supporting ISIS or something, but remember what happened when the US and other countries were saying it is legitimate to send weapons to rebel groups who are fighting the Assad regime, right? We all remember that. Now, unfortunately, some of these people are now fighting with ISIS, and we all know that the weapons or parts of the weapons and the money came from the Gulf region, from Qatar especially, and some came from Saudi Arabia. Now, but that's why I was trying to say, to explain earlier, we have to be really careful, given how the situation is today, that some countries might not see that this is now becoming an Iranian versus Arab influence battle in the region. And I think, therefore, Saudi Arabia has a huge interest right now in trying to push back on the influence and these Shia militias.
Thank you. Paul?
Just very quickly. I mean, I see from, whether rightly or wrongly, Riyadh is under a siege mentality. This is what it's operating under. And I think the radical changes that the king has announced in the government, replacing the crown prince and the new deputy crown prince, that is yet to the implications of that are yet to be felt properly. And we'll have to wait and see what the new, especially the new defense minister, will be doing.
If I may say one, you asked what could the so-called West do. I would sometimes, if you try to have a solution with the Iranians on the nuclear deal, and you are negotiating, or not you, I mean we, I'm also, I was born in Germany, and you see who's negotiating with the Iranians. You don't see any Arab country being in the room, being there. You don't see any neighboring country attending these meetings. What are we expecting? I mean, there is a huge... Imagine the Arabs would start negotiating with Russia over Ukraine. You know, it's just, I mean, as simple as that, to be honest. It's a little...
Yeah. Marisha, hi. Welcome to the panel. I'll give you a little bit of time to just explain to you what we've been talking about so far is really what the support behind ISIS is. And Sheikh Jamal has talked about the Sunni tribes fearing the Shia militias more. I've talked about West allegedly errant policies and the support of Iran and the Iranian militias, the Shia militias. And now we're talking about how to take this forward and what was the role of Saudi Arabia. So I'll take a couple of questions and then turn the floor to you as well. I had a gentleman over here, please.
Good evening. My name is Serge Stroobans and I represent the Institute for Economics and Peace here in Brussels. I would like to thank you for a very nice insights. And as we did not have all diplomats around the table or politicians around the table, I think you gave a really good view of what the problem is. I would like to come back on 2 points. Security situation. So my institute is producing a global terrorist index together with Friends of Europe. We presented it last year in November. And one figure of this index shows that 85% of the casualties of terrorism are found in 5 countries of the region by 4 groups active in the region, and we spoke about a couple of those groups today. Thank you also for your insight on the lack of strategy about the region. And my question is about this strategy. I would like to come back on the successful interventions of the West since, I would say, 1990, and then we can talk about Iraq, we can talk about Afghanistan, we can certainly talk about Syria where there was no intervention, about Libya, we can go back in time about the success we had in Bosnia and in Kosovo and in other places. We see that there is a lack of strategy, there is a lack of long-term strategy. So today we have a coalition that is in fact containing the cancer, it's not combating the cancer. If you see the figures about the amount of ammunition that has been used in 6 months, is the same amount of ammunition that the same amount of ammunition that the Israelis have used in 6 days in 2006 or 8 when they had a problem with Lebanon again in southern Lebanon. So is there really a will to solve the situation, and would the solution not be more and more effective intervention rather than less intervention? Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I could make a plea for questions to be short, because I really want such a fascinating issue, so many challenges to talk about. I'd like everyone to have time to respond. I had Brooks coming in as well. Brooks, or yes, please, could you bring... I've seen everybody say... No, here first, Brooks first. Just put up your hands.
Yes.
Just a very simple question to anyone on the panel, and that is... Brooks Tignor, Jane's Defense. How do you assess the risks of a partition of Iraq, whether along sectarian, geographical lines, whatever? Thank you.
Thank you. Nawab, do you have a question? No. Okay, so Mohammed at the back, please.
Mohammed at the back.
Thank you very much.
To the point, everyone, please.
Yeah, I have three short questions. First of all, I read a report written by Mr. Guy Bouchard, who is the former director of Arab Institute in Paris. He spoke about the role of Brammers, who was the first counsel of USA, in preparing the conditions for the creation of Daesh. What do you think about that? Many experts in Europe are speaking about, even in Arab countries like Abdel Bari Atwan in London, many experts are speaking about Daesh as a state. They have funds, they have population, and they have big territory, large territory. Do you think that at last, at the end, Europeans and USA are going to negotiate with Daesh? We have now the Kurdish state, which is created, and there will be the Islamic State. Do you think that Europeans and Americans are going to negotiate with these so-called states? And last question, I can't imagine, as many Arabs, how does it happen that Daesh appeared suddenly? We know we have many embassies, experts, CIA and other security services. Why weren't able to discover the creation of Daesh? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mohammed. Very, very pertinent questions. Gentlemen over here, please.
Thank you.
I am János Kárpáti, Hungarian News Agency, MTI. You have mentioned that ISIS is recruiting in Europe as well. My question would be, could we hear something more about it? Where mainly? In the more developed western part of Europe, where there are more or less integrated Muslim communities within a basically non-Muslim society, or, for example, in the Balkans, where societies, sub-societies are basically Muslim. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will take, hopefully, another round of questions. I'm going to ask Mariche if we could start with you responding to these questions. Sorry? But I would like you to also answer the questions, the points that were made earlier that I said to you about the role of Iranian Shia militias in destabilizing the region, and that is highlighting an increasing support for ISIS. You've just come back from Iran, in fact. Yes. Please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for including me on the panel, even though I knew I had to be late. So it's a bit difficult to catch up. But let me just respond to a few of the points that I heard from all of your questions. I agree with the frustration about a lack of a strategy, maybe a lack of ambition, but at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge that there's also a lack of easy solutions. I mean, if there would be, you know, an easy way out, people would have gone for it. But what I think we see largely is that what would be needed, and there's a lot of elephants in the room there, are precisely the things that are playing against domestic developments in our own societies. For example, when it comes to the recruitment of foreign fighters, the narrative against Islam sometimes, the narrative with the fear for jihadists rising has long been the monopoly of the far right. And so perhaps that has shunned the political middle, let's say, from engaging, because they were also very keen to oppose the far right for domestic reasons. And I think there's still very much a lack of understanding of the different manifestations of political Islam, the difference between conservatism and extremism and violent jihadism. So I think that there's a lot of need for more knowledge feeding into our own societies. Then, coming to Iran, where indeed I returned a week ago after what was not an easy visit, and it's very clear that foreign policy, regional policies are perhaps the priority of the government and the regime as a whole. Of course, the nuclear file is most talked about, but it's very clear that the whole regional dynamics are opening new avenues for conversation and overlapping interests. You know, that's just a matter of fact that both the EU and the Islamic Republic of Iran has a lot to fear of Daesh. That we would both like to make sure the organization ceases to exist. But it doesn't mean that we have the same long-term goals, and it also doesn't mean that we can accept all the measures that are taken. It's very difficult, for example, if not impossible, when you engage with Iranian politicians to talk about Hezbollah. Any question about it simply remains unanswered. and so I think the sectarianism that's being exploited by almost every side is one of the major problems. And there's not one that can be pointed out as the initiator or the guilty party, because it's been sort of hatred feeding upon hatred, revenge feeding upon revenge. And, you know, that is a risk that I think we see in Iraq. I was in northern Iraq in January, where I think you know, the Kurdish forces, also partially helped by Europeans, are at least holding their own territories, making some gains, but will be, I don't even think, willing or capable to defeat Daesh as such. And I think it's an illusion to suggest that would be possible. And by doing so and by arming Kurdish militias, you may set them up for major attacks that nobody is willing to help them with. So these are just a few fragments to the questions that I heard, but basically coming back to Europe, and then I'll end with my initial responses. it seems to me that the discussions in Europe are still very much fragmented. When we talk about all of the Mediterranean deaths, it is as if that is an isolated problem. There is nearly no connection to the war in Syria, where, frankly, no one is focusing. In fact, we witness a situation where there's de facto acceptance of the existence of the Assad regime that continues to bomb its own people. And I think that's a disgrace. For me, the fact that Europe has been unable to do more to prevent the massive killing of innocent people and the extraordinary violence and the extraordinary humanitarian crisis that has erupted in that region is something that, and I say this very personally, will stay with me for the rest of my life. I cannot imagine why we are unable to do more. I think it is incredible. And all we heard from the beginning from the Assad regime is if you let me go, you'll get the jihadists. Remember that time? And now we have both. So I think Europe needs to do more to connect the dots. Domestic and foreign policies, humanitarian crisis and jihadism, working with countries that traditionally we call our partner countries. I mean, what is the role of Turkey? How can we avoid recruiting happening among the two million or approximately 2 million refugees there? The same in some of the other neighboring countries. The fact that we don't, that by and large there's not a willingness to house these refugees in Europe. The fact that the popular narrative is give them shelter in the region is not the end of the story. What kind of shelter? What are the problems there? How much are we willing to pay to provide some kind of perspective for these people? Because the recipe for disaster lies in enormous amounts of young people with absolutely nothing to lose. And I've been there, I've seen it. It's incredibly painful to see. And I think there is a complete lack of a sense of urgency, both on the difficult questions that are politically extremely difficult, such as engagement or questions about whether to put boots on the ground or arming certain factions, or even on the humanitarian situation. So even though there are different dots or different topics, different elements to this problem, one need is to connect them, two is to increase the level of urgency on the set of problems that we face. And three is not only to prioritize it politically, but to be willing to invest the resources.
Just a very quick follow-up. Who would take the lead in doing that? I mean, we've seen a sort of helplessness. People pass the buck around, if you like. Who, in your view, on the European side or NATO or the US, who should actually be engineering that kind of thinking which goes beyond tomorrow?
Well, I do believe that the EU itself has a big role to play, but with the veto system that we know, it's very difficult to have concerted effort that is sustainable. And the UK example of both not continuing the arms embargo, but then not supplying arms to rebels, I think was really a low point that exemplifies this difficulty in decision-making, and which very directly hinders a long-term perspective. I mean, if one country does not want to extend an embargo or changes the agreement, then it's done. So it's a very fragile initial phase in a common foreign and security policy. And I had hoped that, you know, not only the situation around Russia, but also the situation around Syria would have been more of a wake-up call than it has proven to be. And so I think, of course, NATO can do more, but it will only be focused on the defense side of things, where I believe that we need to seek the overlaps, but also the consequential relation between, let's say, defense and humanitarian problems. When we were in northern Iraq, people were anticipating at some point around the summer, so it may still happen, trying to reclaim Mosul from Daesh. It's still much discussed. People in the region could predict much better than us what this would mean for humanitarian flows, that would be the consequence of taking Mosul. So if you only think about the strategic interest of reclaiming that city, which is a clear one, I think none of us in this room would dispute, but if you don't anticipate what the humanitarian fallout would be, then you create another problem for that region, which is already carrying a huge burden, I think. So this kind of coordination, I don't see happening at this point. So either it happens behind the scenes to an extent that is really invisible, which, you know, would be new. Usually things leak. Or it's just not happening. And this is only one example of where there's a clear connection but no coordination. And I see a set of issues where we should have much more of an overall perspective. And, you know, perhaps that this is one of those problems where the lack of a common approach in Europe is again painfully lacking.
So the lack of forward planning, the lack of the day after scenarios, all the things that make us helpless when things happen, we don't have an answer. But
well, and the lack of public support, yeah, for political leadership for domestic reasons,
yeah,
playing into these foreign policy issues. It's really a very challenging dynamic between domestic issues on, you know, diversity, yeah, and pluralism, budget cuts on defense, lack of willingness to take in refugees, and then how that all determines the narrative on what the problem is instead of looking beyond those domestic issues.
All right, thank you. If you could just pass the microphone to Sheikh Jamal. There were a number of questions, Sheikh Jamal, for you. One was about the partition of Iraq. There was also, is Daesh already a state and will there be negotiations happening with them? And where, I think that's more for Suad, the question about where the recruitment, ISIS recruitment, is most active. So, Sheikh.
للأسف الواقع الحالي في طريقه إلى التقسيم العراق.
Unfortunately, the way what we are going now is going for dividing Iraq.
الحكومة التي في بغداد هي حكومة شيعية.
The government in Baghdad is a Shia government.
لا تمثل كل الشيعة بل هي من حزب الدعوة.
And even if it's not representing all the Shia, it's from Dawa party.
وحزب الدعوة حزب عقائدي.
And Dawa party is actually ideology
كان
party.
منه المالكي.
Maliki was from حزب الدعوة.
والآن العبادي من حزب الدعوة.
And Abadi also.
إبراهيم الجعفري رئيس وزراء الذي هو الآن وزير خارجية.
And before that, Jafari was, which is now he is Minister of Foreign Affairs.
للأسف هؤلاء من حزب الدعوة والذين يحكمون الآن في بغداد هم بيحكمون للشيعة.
Unfortunately, actually, the Shia is ruling.
والآن تأسس جيش أيضا شيعي اسمه الحشد الشعبي. والعراقيين يسمونه الحشد الشيعي.
Army called the الحشد الشعبي.
العراقيون يسمونه الحشد الشيعي لأنه بفتوى شيعية ومن ميليشيات شيعية
and because it is from Shia's militias.
ومناطق السنة تحكمها داعش وهي سنية.
And Sunni area is controlled by Daesh and this is Sunni.
والأكراد تقريبا يعيشون في إقليم ليس منفصل لكنه شبه منفصل.
And the Kurds are living also in their own area. It's practically it's divided, but no.
أحيانا تحصل بينهم وبين المركز.
Sometimes there is some clashes. Some clashes between Daesh and them somewhere.
هذا الذي يحصل إذا قسم على أساس طائفي.
So that's what's going on now. If it will be divided according to religion, one state, Sunni state, and
ستخرج
one
المشكلة عن
Shia
state. مشكلة
so the
محلية.
Problem will come out to the outside. It will not stay only local
لأنه
problem.
لأنه المناطق السنية تتعرض لهجوم ميليشيات ومدعومة من إيران.
Are being attacked, are being, you know.
وهناك دولتان جارتان الأردن والسعودية والدولتان سنيتان.
And Jordan and the Saudis are Sunni's countries bordering.
فإذا حصلت معركة على أساس سني شيعي.
And if there will be battle, if the battle will be Sunni and Shia.
على هاتين الحكومتين أن تنحاز لخيار شعوبها السنة.
So the government in Jordan and Saudis has to take a part.
وإذا لزمت الحياد قطعا ستنهار.
And if they
فترة.
Will not take part supporting the Sunnis, after a while they will fall.
تلتحق السعودية والأردن
and Jordan and Saudis of course will be merged with the Sunnis
فتكبر دولة السنة ويكبر الصراع
so the state of Sunni will be bigger and the problem will be bigger and it will be transported
للأسف هذا الذي يعني
unfortunately
إذا
that's what's going on
هكذا,
if the situation will stay like this
ولن تبقى في المنطقة
and it will not stay in our area
لأنه السنة أكثر من مليار
There is because the Sunni is more than a billion.
Afghanistan and Pakistan. الآن الآن إيران تجلب من الهزارة أفغان يقاتلون إلى جانب الميليشيات الشيعية.
Now Afghani people are also fighting along with the Shia militias.
هؤلاء سيستفزون الأفغان السنة.
So these people will actually tease the Sunni Afghani.
ويستفزون الباكستاني.
And the Pakistanis
and
the Caucasians and all the rest will go to support ISIS.
فعندها قد لا يسهل السيطرة على هذا الحريق.
And afterwards it will be actually uncontrollable situation.
لذلك نحن هنا نحذر.
So that's why we are here and we are just asking people to take care from what's going on from the situation nowadays.
Thank you very much. Paul, this is Sheikh Jamal has painted a rather catastrophe scenario, very scary scenario across the Muslim world in a sense. Do you have any insights on whether this is not too much of a nightmare scenario? Or do you really see this developing? And secondly, Marish's question about thinking for later on, you know, connecting the dots, having a narrative which goes just beyond what's happens today, thinking about tomorrow as well.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more with Sheikh Jamal. It's an easy answer to say, oh, let's just split up Iraq. It's, you know, we'll put borders everywhere, except that there is Baghdad, you know. But it will lead to this greater, wider conflict throughout the region, which then leads into, well, what should the West actually be doing? What should the international community be doing in this strategic framework? And in fact, I think it's looking at leadership and positive leadership within the region. What we do not have throughout the whole of the Arab world is a positive view of the future for young people. The lack of jobs, the lack of education, the lack of social inclusion, economic inclusion, where we've got very rich people in yachts who have planes and have yachts for planes with more planes in the Gulf, and mass poverty on the other side of the Arab world. There is this lack of a positive leader who can set out a vision for the whole of the Arab world. And that is something that the West has to take on board. And it needs to take on board not with military might, and not with dropping Humvees or Kalashnikovs everywhere, but looking at trade issues, looking at economic support, creating this strategic narrative that there is a positive tomorrow, which is not happening right now.
Sorry, I have to push back a little on this, because I was just telling him it's a bit like Europe. I was wondering what the young people in Greece and other countries would say about, the rich north or, you know, we have to be... I think it's a bit too easy, this kind of explanation, because in Iraq, if we look at Iraq before 2003, this wasn't about jobs whatsoever, right? And I mean, also many of the so-called Arab Spring protests, they were not about implementing, the kind of democracy we have here, the kind of Western democracy that we like or that we have here in their countries. I mean, and I would also say we have to look at each country case by case. But, you know, Marici, you said something very interesting about how during the talks in Iran now a week ago, there's some overlap in interests and that they are fearing ISIS as much as the Europeans. I remember when you and I happened to be on the same trip to Iran last year, I heard some of the Iranian officials saying constantly, we are fighting the war on terror, we are fighting the war on terror. And I remember I wrote a piece for the Washington Post. The title my editor chose was, Why ISIS is the Best That Happens to the U.S.-Iranian Relationship. And I'm sorry, I could say the same for the EU-Iranian relationship. And before you came, we were actually talking about how dangerous and how much of feeding into a vicious circle, into the narrative of ISIS, actually it is that that it's only seen into an Iranian Western interest. No, ISIS, dear friends here, is also an enemy to any ruling country, Arab ruling country in the region. The way ISIS sees the world is it's you either accept my ideology or you're an enemy. There had been enough Sunnis who had been beheaded because they were not accepting the ISIS ideology. And we have to be very, very careful. I'm saying this again. I said this at the beginning. Not to really look at things as in black and white. It's they are the enemy of the Iranians because the Iranians are Shia. They're the enemy of the Westerners or of Europe because we are Westerners. We are non-Muslims or non-Sunnis. And therefore we should align with them. No, it's not that easy. And please, this is the time where we all have to be aware. We had too many years looking for easy answers. And I'm very grateful, Marito, you brought this up. It's not that easy. And it's not as black and white as many people see it. And I would like to get back to some of the questions asked. Why out of a sudden Daesh? I'll be very frank with you. I had tremendous discussions. I was working briefly before I went to Harvard for a year for a German magazine before I rejoined US media. And I remember I had huge debates because I saw people from Europe, so-called jihadis, who I've known for many years, traveling to Libya and to Syria. And I was telling, this was in the midst of 2011, and I was telling these editors, look, I see some jihadis going towards the region. I went to Lebanon. I interviewed some Salafi jihadists there who told me this is the Islamic Spring. It's perfect. It's wonderful. We're using all this turmoil to actually enter the countries to recruit, and nobody cares. And this is why they had, a lot of time to do so. They had a lot of time to set up. They had a lot of time to recruit. And don't forget, there was a certain moment where, ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, they used to work together, but then they got divided because there was this fight between Baghdadi and al-Julani about the leadership. So it's not out of a sudden, but it's about, do you want to see them or you don't want to see them, right? Okay, the second question was Daesh as a state. It's very interesting. Actually, there was an article written by Stephen Wald from Harvard University, who actually also was trying to build a scenario around what happens if Daesh would declare today a state and how should the West react. Maybe it could be of interest to you. It's on his foreign policy blog. Daesh today is acting as if they are a state. They are collecting, they don't call it tax, but they are collecting money from business people. They have a security system set up in Raqqa and other places. They have hospitals that are fully functioning. They have a social system, a social security system. They have certain rules. They are acting as if they are a state, and they are setting up water pipelines for people. They have bakeries. Somebody told me, actually, you can even buy Red Bull or Toblerone if you have the money, in Raqqa, at least. I don't know about Mosul, but in Raqqa, apparently, the supermarkets are are functioning, everything is there, and they have a system. Of course, for women, it's not a really nice place to be in. Also for others. They even, imagine, one of the first thing they did was they changed the school books. They have a minister for education who, by the way, is German, of Egyptian descent. Very known, old kind of jihadist background, fought in Bosnia and so on. And so it's not, this is not, they are working. They have a system and it's working. They have a security system. They have their intelligence services. It is, so what it is. Will Western countries reach out or negotiate with them? I don't know. I will not comment to this. Ask the politician, I would say. And the recruiting. As much as I mentioned the system within the state, they have I must say, unfortunately, very, very fantastic, you have to say, actually, media system. It is incredible what the output they are producing on daily basis, translated like the message of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, one of the latest messages, was came out in Arabic, then translated into English, German, French, Russian. I forgot the language. I think it was Spanish. I have to look it up. But, you know, and it's incredible. The videos are getting translated, subtitled, and it's unfortunately working. You see a lot of young people. You asked me from where. I can tell you I've covered or had to profile even converts, people who had just recently converted to Islam, from the Netherlands, from Denmark, from Germany, and
Belgium
as well, yes. So it is not only one region, they are targeting many, many places, but also Russia, for example. And yes, you mentioned former Yugoslavia. By the way, there was a video just recently, 3 days ago, which I watched in one of their outlets, that is focusing or targeting especially people from Bosnia. So they are targeting people all over, and I mean it's spreading. They are in Libya. They are they have people who sworn allegiance in all parts of the world, and it's not stopping. I mean it's going on.
Rachel, would you like to come in?
Thank you. I think perhaps one of the other unpleasant consequences of not a clear strategy on the part of the EU is that everybody pins a strategy onto the EU and blames the EU for everything. Because, you know, to say that the EU is helping, you know, what some people claim Shia militia, or the other way around, Iranians blaming the EU for creating Daesh, is all, I think, very, very oversimplified. And again, feeding into this narrative. But what you do see is a gravitation towards those who are willing and able to fight Daesh. That is, I think, what we see happening. So not so much a strategic or ideological overlap with the Islamic Republic or even with the Kurdish areas of Iraq, but simply looking around who is there and seeking out what to do. I mean, it is quite remarkable to see a vote in the European Parliament where the Green Group supports taking PKK off the terrorist list, where we see Greens that are generally against any kind of military intervention asking for military intervention in countries like Syria. I mean, this conflict and the past 5 years have seen completely different alliances develop all over the place. And what I think should be much more underlined and also clear from what we do and don't do is that the EU should not play into the hands of sectarianism. And sometimes it happens with the best intentions. We have Christian democratic groups who believe that it may be helpful to grant visas, particularly for Christians, who of course are persecuted and repressed in a way that is heartbreaking. But I spoke to a bishop in northern Iraq who said, please don't do this, because if we are encouraged to leave this country, it helps the ethnic cleansing. We are Iraqis. We are Syrians. You know, we don't want to leave, and we don't want Daesh to succeed in getting us out of here one way or another. And so we have to really think twice about what we do and what the impact in the region is. The same goes for how we deal with a country like Egypt. Look at the cycle of statements and the way we've dealt with the Egyptians. One, when the first demonstrations for a more just, free, democratic society happened, when Mubarak left, when Morsi came into office, when the demonstrations against Morsi happened. And what are we doing now? Well, nothing. If the As Suad said, if Daesh was, you know, sort of a blessing, it was certainly also a blessing for the Egyptian government, because counterterrorism is allowing them to completely reinvent Sisi in the international community, for people to conveniently forget or not pay attention to the massive repression of anything from Muslim Brotherhood members to seculars, to journalists, to students. I mean, it is very clear that our choices, sometimes even when they're implicit, so when we're seen as not doing anything, are making a choice for, I think, short-term interests, while I would think that the EU can make its best effort and a bigger impact by focusing much more clearly on our values. I still believe a lot of young people all over the world are longing for recognition of their desire to be free, safe, whether man or woman, whether minority or majority, and that Europe still has this reputation of being, you know, democratic and open, but we're not acting accordingly.
That's right. Yeah.
And that should also be reflected in the way we deal with countries like Saudi Arabia. I mean, talking about double standards and the role that that country is playing, I think it is time for tough choices, and I don't see those being made, unfortunately. And it also reveals a lack of certainty about who we are and who we want to be ourselves.
Mm. Very wise comments indeed, Marici. I think that deserves a debate in itself, actually. And we've just had a debate on human rights and European values as how they're applied in the rest of the world. But thank you for raising those very valid points. Paul, very quickly, your comments, and then I'll give the final word.
Yes. I'm based in Washington, D.C., even though I have this funny accent. And what we're seeing right now, and we saw on Saturday and today, is the start of the U.S. election, where maybe $2 billion will be spent fighting two candidates together. And we're going to get a spiral of decision-making and speeches that may not touch on any relevant truth. And I think it's very important for discussions like this and for all of us and to listen to Iraqis about what is actually going on the ground. And I think it's for all of us, policymakers, commentators, journalists, to take into account what is really needed in Iraq and to let the Iraqis make their own decisions going forward.
You mean their own decisions?
Yes.
Yes, it came across as the wrong decision.
Oh,
sorry. No, that's fine. Thank you very much. Yes. No, and that's how I want to end this discussion, Sheikh Jamal, by asking you, your organization is called Peace Ambassadors for Iraq. So are you ruling out any kind of reconciliation between the two Shias and Sunnis in Iraq? Or what exactly do you think can be done? Is there hope? Because I don't want to end this conversation with too much of a pessimistic note.
I have.
This is the main goal of the NGO which we established, Peace Ambassadors of Iraq.
Because
in the end, I agree with Ms. Marita what she said about what happens and what's going on. Because actually the one that who pays the price is the Iraqi people. No one is talking about it. And all the money and all the all the conferences is talking about Daesh. No one is talking about these people who are dying every day and all this. That's why this NGO is trying to communicate with the international community and governments to listen to the Iraqi people. Now we have 3 million refugees in Iraq.
لا توجد منظمات إنسانية ولن تستطيع أن تدخل هذه المنظمات
no
الإنسانية
human rights, there is no any organization
ولا يوجد طريق
to help.
يصلون به إلى كردستان باعتبارها منطقة آمنة وبغداد مقفلة
and Baghdad is closed.
حصلت عندنا تجربة في عام 2005 و2006
so we had the same one experience in 2005-2006
استضافت الجامعة العربية مؤتمر مصالحة للشعب العراقي.
And the Arab League, made a reconciliation.
وهذا المؤتمر لو قدر له أن ترى مقرراته النور لما حال العراق والمنطقة الآن هكذا.
If this conference had at least a light or a way to to get the result. It was a good, actually, conference, if you remember about it, and just
didn't have chance to. الآن موجودة في العراق هي ليست سابقة. حصلت في كثير من دول العالم وكان للأمم المتحدة دور إيجابي في إرساء.
What happened in Iraq now, it happens also in other countries, but in other countries also the United Nations had a role, had missions, and they were doing their things there.
تستطيع الأمم المتحدة أن تسعى وتقوم بدور ليعم
the United Nations had roles in other countries to give peace and to play big roles in at least trying to find a solution, peaceful solution.
فهذا ما نسعى إليه في
and that's what we are looking for, at least, to have a solution. Thank you very much for your...
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll wrap up a discussion which I think has been really revealing and insightful, but I have to say leaves me quite still confused and perturbed about how this is going to evolve. It is an extremely complicated puzzle. We've just mentioned a few elements of this nasty, toxic puzzle that is evolving in the region, but I think this discussion needs to continue here. I'm sorry, we've come to the end of our discussion. I can't take any more questions. So I think first of all, thank you very much for your questions, comments. I think they were very useful to take the debate forward. And to thank our panelists. As you said, Paul, it was an unusual constellation of people who joined us for this discussion. So, Maricha, thank you very much. Sheikh Jamal, Johnny,
just for
Paul.
Yes? I would like to request for correction. In the constellation, Mr. Sheikh Jamal said one thing. And we heard something else,
yes?
Particularly regarding Afghans fighting yeah. in support of...
Afghani Sunni supported, he said that the Afghani Sunnis yeah. was...
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Because Afghans are not fighting against anyone in anywhere else. There are rumors.
Okay.
But we don't have any
proof.
Actually, my question was regarding Daesh in Afghanistan, and why I didn't get the chance.
Okay. But we will continue. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The conversation, as I said, is a complex one, and of course, you're welcome to talk about this later on. But thank you very much for pointing that out as well. So I was in the process of thanking our panelists. I got as far as Sheikh Jamal. So Paul, thank you very much, and Swaz, thank you very much indeed. Please join me in saying thank you to them.